Hello, the first episode of season two of University Registrars and Others, talking about stuff, is a landmark in more ways than one. My guest this time is Professor Chris Husbands, Vice-Chancellor of Sheffield Hallam University, who's just announced that he's to leave his role at the end of the year after 8 years in charge. We talk about Chris's career prior to Hallam, which included 6 years teaching in London comprehensives, stints training teachers, and as head of two university schools of education, before he became Director of the Institute of Education in London and led it into merger with UCL. Exploring the distinctive nature of and challenges faced by schools of education, we also discuss the transferability of classroom teaching skills to university leadership, from assembly organisation to debates about bog paper requirements in medieval monasteries. Yes, really. As VC at Hallam, Chris initiated some significant strategic and cultural changes, which he feels have really had a major long-term impact, including the Hallam model for the curriculum, which will certainly continue, along with the civic impact of the university. Part of the approach is also about ensuring fully joined up operations across academic and professional departments, learning from The Blob, that's the movie by the way, not the Michael Gove alternative, and focusing on a shared plan and avoiding to try and do too much. Finally, we learn that Chris has no plans for what he's going to do after Hallam, but he doesn't want to find himself staring into what he described as a chasm of emptiness in a year's time and yearning to read health and safety reports and financial statements. I'm sure we'll see him involved in the sector in some capacity in future though. I do hope you enjoy it.
Welcome then to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, and it's my enormous pleasure yet again to talk to a non-registrar, but someone even better than a registrar. It's Professor Chris Husbands, who is Vice-Chancellor of Sheffield Hallam University and a long acquaintance of mine over many years. We'll come on to that. So welcome, Chris. It's great to be talking to you.
It's great to be here, Paul. Really looking forward to the conversation.
Right, so I wanted to talk a bit about how you ended up at Sheffield Hallam. I mean, it's fair to say that unusually we've picked a date for our recording barely 24 hours after you announced your standing down as Vice Chancellor of Sheffield Hallam, with a real tear in your eye and real sadness after 6 years of what will be 7 years of sterling service. It will be 8 years of sterling service, right? even longer than I thought. Anyway, we'll come on to the reflections to that in a moment. But let's talk a bit about the journey about how you ended up there. So where did it all begin, Chris?
So where did it all begin? So look, like so many people of my generation, now I was the first person in my family not just to go to university but to stay at school beyond the minimum school leaving age. I went to university. I did reasonably well, did a PhD, completed my PhD in the early 1980s when everybody thought that there was no future in higher education, that jobs were shutting down. And the one thing I wanted to do when I finished my PhD was to be with my then girlfriend and my now wife. And I went off to London. I became a school teacher. I spent 6 years teaching in urban comprehensive schools. Was promoted through the ranks in schools up to the point where I thought that quite a lot of the organisational administration I was having to do in schools wasn't quite what I signed up for when I became a school teacher.
And
we'll come to that, because it turns out that I was wrong and that's the really, really interesting stuff. But I moved into teacher education. I trained history teachers. I moved on to running teacher education programs. I was head of schools of education, and I became my first head of institution job. I became director of the Institute of Education, University of London, which I, for all the right reasons, merged into UCL. And at that stage, I was wondering, I'd become more and more interested in the dynamics of higher education leadership, of how you get things to happen in the right sort of way, in these really interesting, complex, often loosely connected organisations. And I was very interested, having had a career that substantially focused on my discipline and a very research intensive approach to my discipline, interested in the opportunity to run a multi-faculty university, and that brought me at the beginning of 2016 to be Vice Chancellor at Sheffield Hallam.
So that is a really interesting career trajectory, and quite an unusual one, I think, for Vice Chancellors. I mean, there can't be many who've come through that school teacher route. And I'll ask you in a minute whether or not, you know, it's actually a helpful set of attributes that you've got from those days when running a university. But go back to your aside about being head of a few schools of education and such. I mean, you know, our paths first crossed at University of East Anglia and then at Warwick University, where I was enormously privileged to work with you on a particular project at Warwick. But I mean, those were big deals, weren't they? Because it was challenging times for schools of education in universities then.
Yeah, and I think what's really, and we'll come, well, I, one of the things we might want to explore, and I don't want to use over academic words in this, we want to talk about liminality and the way institutions operate at their margins. Because I think what's interesting about schools of education is that when they're at their best, they're finding ways to work both successfully within the academy, and they're undertaking all the high quality teaching, high quality research that's really important in higher education, but they're also exercising influence in the professional world, in schools and colleges. When I was leading School of Education at Institute of Education at Warwick, School of Education at UEA, it is that sense that you are part of the things that connect the university to the world beyond the university. And that intellectually, how you lead at the edges is something that has always interested me.
Yeah, I remember ideally loved hanging out in the School of Education in both institutions, because that was where the fun people were. I mean, yeah, admittedly, some of them were slightly on the edge of what you would normally expect in university. But that was where you got a sense of, you know, excitement and intellectual enthusiasm, but also touching, you know, real world difficult stuff, which you didn't always get in other departments.
I think that's right. I used to think the School of Education are not the only places where that should happen. It should happen in medical schools. It should happen in social work. It should happen in nursing and so on. But I think that sense of, I think one of the really interesting questions, this question of liminality, it's about how should organisations be in an increasingly flexible, interconnected world? And at their worst, universities can be inward-looking, they can be overly obsessed with their own processes. At their best, they can find ways of working in flexible, dynamic ways with institutions that have different priorities, that have different performance indicators, that have different funding models. But if you're going to do that successfully, you've really got to make serious attempts to stand in the shoes of other people and be able to look at your world in different ways. And I think one of the things I learned on my way up is that doing that is hard work, but it always pays off.
Yeah. We'll move on from schools of education in a moment, but I mean, they're facing particular challenges at the moment, right? Because of the way the government's been. Is there anything, do you think, in the way that universities or education bodies within universities could have done things differently in the past 10, 20 years, yeah, that would have meant we'd actually ended up in a, you know, not in this position? Are the things we should have done?
So I think that there's a sort of yes and a no answer to that. There was, I think, the big push, which coincided with my early days in higher education, the big push on partnership in teacher education in the 1990s. And I think that the implementation of that, for a whole range of reasons, was variable on both sides. And I think if schools of education had grabbed that more successfully at scale, we might be in a different place. We might be. But there is a deep suspicion from some parts of the political world of schools of education. And you get similar things in the United States, but it hasn't worked through in anywhere near the same degree. So I think that there are bits of ideology that are going to make life extremely difficult. And for the avoidance of doubt, I think that, the way that the reaccreditation process has happened has been ill thought through. And the contradictions between the accreditation process and the Ofsted frameworks seem to me to be very, very difficult to fathom. I don't quite know what happens next. I'm always cautious when I talk to my colleagues in my own Institute of Education here at Sheffield Hallam to say, look, I'm 7 or 8 years out of date on teacher education. Yeah. You shouldn't look to me. There was one thing that I will sort of say in passing is the question you sort of planted that you might not come back to, which was about whether those early days in schools had what I took away from that. So it is perfectly true that you know, if you want students to be put into a nice, neat line before they go into a seminar room, then I'm your man. I can still do that. And if you want an assembly, I can rustle one of those up for you pretty quickly. There's a couple of serious points, the first is that I went into urban comprehensive schools, having been a pretty studious individual, and the fact of having to unpack the things I was interested in ways that youngsters weren't necessarily interested in was something I've always taken with me. A little story I tell is that I remember one afternoon with a lower set group of 12-year-olds, and for reasons best known to me, we were labelling a picture of a medieval monastery. And Mark, I can remember him very clearly, says to me, "Here, sir, what did they use for bog paper?" And I thought, well, this is fine. I know the answer to this. I've read the books. So I said, "Well, Mark, they use leaves." And he said, quick as a flash, "What did they use in the winter then? Holly?" And I thought that and I'd never thought about that. I'd read the textbooks and thought, yeah, they use leaves, that's fine. But Mark, it was that there are perspectives on the world that are quite different. And I think that sensitivity of having had 6 years at the beginning of my career, when I was operating in a different environment, I think has been enormously valuable. And just sometimes it's encouraged me to take, with a slight pinch of salt, some of the things that I've run up against in various universities.
Fantastic. And yeah, Mark, now VP at Microsoft, obviously.
Well, he's either VP in Microsoft or doing 30 years for armed robbery. I mean, it's one of the two.
That's great. So then moving forward then to your arrival at Sheffield Hallam, and when you arrived at Hallam, I mean, it's very different to the Institute of Education in London, and I don't think you'd had much acquaintance with the city. You know, it's very different kind of place to what you were used to, you know, the backwaters of East Anglia and what have you. But sorry, that was just completely gratuitous, and you obviously lived many other places as well. Right. But I mean, it was a new place, a new culture, a new environment and a new institution. So how did you find it, and what did you decide to change? And
that's a really, really good question. Because you're right, I wasn't somebody who was embedded either in teaching intensive parts of the university of the sector, or in the north of England. And you know, in some respects, I'm very grateful. Well, lots of respects, I'm very grateful that the Board of Governors decided that I was worth taking a gamble on. I remember ever so clearly. It was a 2-day interview. I remember phoning home at the end of the first day, and I said to Nikki, my wife, "This looks a really interesting job. I'd really like to do this." So it was really, I sensed something here about its context that was going to be incredibly interesting. It's a big university. When I arrived, it was one of the biggest universities in the sector, still one of the biggest, but other places have also now grown. It's 36,000 students. Really interesting mix. So we do draw students from 100 countries around the world, but 50% of our undergraduate students have grown up within 50 miles of Sheffield, and that makes it a university of place. I thought it was really interesting. I thought it was welcoming. I thought it was diverse. I thought that it lacked confidence, it lacked coherence, and it lacked heft in terms of what it was trying to do. And the first thing I thought, I thought two things. One of them is because now felt quite new at the time, but it's become quite obvious. It's become quite obvious. I wasn't going to write a five-year strategy. I used to teach education leadership, and one of my set pieces was to give students copies of university strategic plans with the names of the university removed, and they had to try to work out to match up the plan to the university. It was almost impossible to do. They all look pretty much the same. So I said that we're going to have at least a 15-year strategy, and that has become more common, but it wasn't common in 2015. And we have a long-term story, and I wanted a story that was going to be expressed in such simple language that absolutely everybody in the university could identify with it and sign up. And I think that one of the most important things that leaders do is to tell stories. Now, it was really important that it wasn't just my story. So I spent a long time just walking around, hanging out, listening to people, listening to academics, listening to cleaners, listening to the security team, listening to administrators. I was trying to find the story that would resonate. And the story that I landed on, I called it at the time the story of the applied university. And the phrase I wanted to use was the story of the university for the real world, which had sort of been nicked by Queensland University of Technology. And on some of their versions, it had Queensland University of Technology and a little R in a circle. So I was a bit cautious about that. So I talked about the applied university,
yeah.
But it was that sense of the university that engages with the real world,
yeah.
Engages with the world beyond. And we stuck to that. And some of my team said, yeah, we need to be a really outstanding applied university. So I said best in the country, and one of my teams said no, best in the world. So we talked about the world's leading applied university. We're not there yet, but we're on the way. And absolutely critical, there were things I then wanted to do. Actually, I didn't, and I was a little bit slow on this. I didn't want to do an academic reorganization for its own sake.
Yeah,
I thought that was, to some extent, it's the oldest trick in the new leader's book. But I did want to find a way of changing the culture, and the culture had to be more about a university of place, a university of purpose, and a university that engaged with preparing this really diverse population for the next steps on their journey. So it was about culture, it was about, and we told the story, and we kept telling the story. There's a line that Peter Mandelson has, which is that in political campaigning, when people get sick and tired of hearing the message is when they've just about started to get it. And we kept talking about a small number of things. And the hard work is not designing the story. That is interesting. But the hard work is keeping the discipline, of sticking to the drumbeat, of sticking to the priorities. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. But I also am very pleased. It's one of the things that pleases me most of all is that I do have members of the domestic team, members of the catering team, some very junior people who talk about the applied university, who talk about the university for the real world, and that makes me feel that we've landed the story.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good. I think that, you know, connects back to your school teacher days again. Right? The storytelling bit, is leaving aside Leaves and Holly, is actually really important in terms of engaging with people. But you're absolutely right. I mean, universities are places where there is constant bombardment of noise and different messages all the time from all across different levels of the university, but particularly from different parts of senior management. And therefore, having that consistency of story and consistency of line and message again and again and again to give everything else a foundation is really difficult to achieve. So that is marvellous that you've achieved it. So what other things then are you proud of, or are you most pleased with that you've, you know, that, well, let's not say legacy, but things that will continue for more than 10 minutes after you've left?
Well, we always have to be a bit cautious about that, don't we? Because none of us know what's going to happen after we've gone. And I won't ever criticise anybody for making different choices from the ones I've made. There are a couple that I think are really important to us. First, we invested a lot of time in this, and it was flagged up in our early priorities on the strategy. I felt that an absolutely critical part of the story was a more coherent approach to the way we designed curriculum. And again, this is part of telling a story. So we did a lot of work on something that we now call the Hallam model. And the Hallam model is not a curriculum delivery tool. So it doesn't tell people how to teach. I had a quite firm argument with another senior member of staff who'd done a presentation on what he thought was his version of the Hallam model, which was about pedagogy. And I said, no, we are not telling people how to teach. We're giving them some curriculum design principles, four simple curriculum design principles, courses: engage, challenge, collaborate, thrive. The four, right. And how that plays out in computing as compared to nursing, as compared to fashion management, they may be quite different, but we're saying to everybody, use the language, use the frame, pick it up and run with it. And again, it's simple language to get some powerful ideas over, so that the Hallam model, I hope, will last and has been so far reasonably robust. We've talked a lot about Civic and that US base. My board chair is Bob Kerslake, who produced the Civic University report. It chimed and we've been able to pick that up. So I think the civic engagement, the sense of putting yourself at the centre of the city, at the centre of the region, will survive. But I'm also pretty clear that whoever replaces me will want to do some things differently. And I think those of us who do lead in higher education, we ought to be bold enough and brave enough to say, we lead, we are stewards, other people will come along, they will do this job differently from us. I remember when I left Warwick, your friend and mine very, very late lamented, much missed, Jonathan Nichols was the registrar at Warwick. And I said to Jonathan that I was working really hard to make sure that after I'd left, nobody said, well, we wouldn't be in this awful mess if it wasn't for Chris Husbands. And his response to me was, well, why should you be different from anybody else? And it was a perfectly right thing to say, you know, and people will do things differently. And I think we just need to be grown up about that.
He was a master of wise words, was Jonathan, and a much missed mentor for many of us. I mean, that's great to hear. I mean, you talked about cultural change as well. And one, you know, cultural change is one of those things that are often talked about in the context of universities and particularly leadership teams as well, but very difficult to actually deliver because it takes time. And also, it can be blown off course. So what has your approach to cultural change been within Hallam, and how far has it gone, do you think?
It's a great question, and you know, the other thing about culture change is that it is fourth bridge stuff. It is, you know, culture is the way we do things around here. That's really important. There are things that we have done, and some really important things that we have done around career structures, career pathways. The academic careers framework that underpins all our promotion and annual review. So we lock that in. I can talk more about that. People can look that up on our website. We've invested a lot of time in leadership development, in middle leadership development in particular. I think we are, again, those of us who have the jobs that we do need to be pretty frank that the people who actually run universities are middle leaders. It's the heads of department, it's the heads of section. Those are the people who are the absolutely critical connectors between the grand vision and the research projects and the students and, you know, the day-to-day operation. If you haven't got that absolutely locked in, then you have no chance of making anything happen. So investing in that, but also, again, this sense of common language is really important. So we talk about the Hallam deal, which has five components and feeds through the way we engage staff. I do think, and I've pushed my team on this, before the pandemic, every member of the senior leadership team was spending a day a month back to the floor, or the visible leadership. I've put a lot of time in invisibility. One of the things I hated most about the pandemic is that when I wanted to walk the buildings, there was nobody see me. So I took to doing, I do a weekly video. I front up all of our open days. I front up all, we do an induction for new staff every month. I front that up. I tell them the story. I tell them where they fit. Now, I don't think that's critical, but I do think that sense of the visible leadership, reinforcing the messages and keeping at it is very important. But you know, the technical stuff matters too, the diversity networks, the the approach to annual review, the approach to promotions criteria, the approach to career, all those things matter and are really important. You have to keep working at people. We went through a big exercise just at the beginning of the pandemic. We planned it anyway, went ahead with it, of articulating our core values as a university. We're taking every member of the university through protect and respect training. And again, I and other members of the senior team are fronting up each of those. You've got to show that it matters. You've got to show that it's there. And you've got to be prepared to listen to tough feedback. One of the nice things we've done, I don't claim credit for this, it was handed to me, is random coffee. Works really well. So anybody across the university bungs their name into a hat, you get matched up once a month for a random coffee. And it's great. It's absolutely great. And it's just ways of, the universities that they've become big organizations. There is a line, a paragraph in the Robbins report from 1961. I read a reference to it. I've never quite checked this out myself, but I must check it out, which says something like, it's impossible to conceive that any university could ever be more than 4,000 students in size because it would have no sense of community. Well, now we would regard a university of less than 4,000 as really struggling on the verges of viability. We've become big institutions and we're disconnected institutions often. What happens in the School of Law and what happens in the School of Computing feel very different. So you've got to make an absolutely huge effort to keep pulling these centrifugal entities together with the common story, the common language, the common framework.
That's really, really impressive set of activities, and I couldn't agree more. One of the areas of tension sometimes in universities, and I've spoken to your one of your deputies, Richard Calvert, about this earlier on the podcast, is the the potential tension between academic and professional staff, and is that something that you've managed to overcome at Hallam over time?
So the first thing is that I think that we can make the problem worse by overstating it. I think it is possible to overstate it. I think there are differences. I think there are differences in cultures. I think there are differences in approaches. I think there's probably two or three things we've done. We've tried as far, just in terms of our messages, I try not to talk about different cadres of staff. And Richard has been anything that has been achieved at Sheffield Hallam could not have been achieved without Richard Calvert, who has been an absolutely fantastic colleague to work with. He talked at the beginning about one university, and we really pushed that. So we no longer have an interesting approach to development planning. So what normally happens in universities? When a new strategy is written or whatever, is that you define your priorities and you hand over to departments and colleges or faculties or professional service units as part of their annual planning process. You tell them to define their plans in relation to the new strategy. And look, I've been a head of department, and I know that the trick there is often to do what you want to do anyway and dress it up in the words that you know that the Pro Vice Chancellor wants to hear. And so we've taken a very different approach. It's took us a long while to get there. We no longer have individual plans for individual departments or colleges. We have a single university plan. It defines our priorities. And what it has really helped us to do is to still see that we're trying to do too much. And often, you know, there's really good research that I read something just last week from a McKinsey report that only about 25% of senior executives in the States believe that their institutional strategy had any hope whatsoever of getting through to implementation. And we do this, but you know, we know what the problems are. So we've gone for a single university plan. And if you're doing a single university plan, you've got to identify ways in which your registry and your departments can work together to make this happen. So keep coming back to it, and I think we've made a load of progress, but this is you never quite get there. It's a bit, you know, there's still the case that across any complex organization, people try to put their own priorities, they try to smuggle things in. There's a very good 1958 B movie called The Blob. And the blob is this device that takes over an American town. It moves like an enormous, it is this enormous blobby stuff that Doris said. And eventually, spoils the plot of anybody who wants to watch it. Eventually, they solve the problem by freezing the blob. And at the very end of the movie, they're interviewing the police chief who came up with the idea of freezing it. But they interview him under arc lights. And of course, the heat of the arc lights begins to melt the ice again and the blob is back. And I think that sense of you have to keep an eye out, and local initiative matters, of course it does. But you've got to mobilize a lot of people around a common purpose. And if you can't do that, then I think you will weaken your ability to shift the organization effectively.
Yeah, no, that's really, really well put, Chris. And I think your point about every institution tries to do too much, right? You know, and you find that as you, no matter how pointed, leaving aside Helen, how pointed your strategic goals are, once you start to spray them out, they grow and they grow and they grow. And then you've got all the stuff that other people, you know, people want to do anyway, that they will say, you know, they will try and fit under the goals somehow, right? Because they don't want to not do it, because it's their particular project. Yeah, I absolutely get that. So that's really impressive to hear. Look, we're running short of time. I appreciate your time, very precious. But the thing I did want to ask you that you've already alluded to is, you know, you've seen a lot in your long career in higher education. So give us something amusing or interesting or unusual or distinctive that you'd like to share with listeners.
Well, it is an observation around professional academic staff, and I owe this to somebody else, but I will now steal it as my own. So the more once they've been pointed out to me, I suppose. If you talk to academics, they will tend to say, I work at Nottingham, or I work at Hallam, or I work at Oxford. If you talk to professional staff, they will say, I work for Nottingham, I work for Hallam. And I think that there is a big shift here. Academics work at, and they have quite a transactional relationship with the organization, and they will take their teaching and their research and they will move it around. And professional staff work for, and if there's one bit of fairy dust that I could sprinkle over, I think it's got to be working for me trumps working at. But it is really interesting, and one of the it does spill over into something else that I think is serious for the sector. And I know that you asked for a lighthearted, reasonably lighthearted, but this does spill to. I think we all need to be. We're all, aren't we, looking at the moment as to how we prepare our budgets for next year against 10% inflation on essentially largely flat income. We can volumize some of it, but the unit cost is getting pretty challenging. I think that's all the more difficult for universities at the moment because they had it easy during the years of austerity. The 2012 fee settlement essentially let universities off the hook. And that's why university campuses are now looking in much better nick than local authority offices or schools. but it is tough, and it is going to get tougher. And I don't think that there's a serious chance of us getting through that together unless we can really burrow down into some of these cultural issues that lead our institutions to be a bit less joined up, a bit less corporate, a bit less collective, a bit less communitarian than they might otherwise be. We are all in this together. And we took earlier this week, my executive leadership team, the top 25 or so decision makers in the organization, through our budgetary assumptions. And I said to them, you know, we are not going to be saying to you at any point that we are handing to you the responsibility to find 5% or 7% or 8% or whatever it is. We will do this together. We will do this collectively. We will work with each other because this is a problem for all of us. And if there is a way of getting through this productively, it has got to be through working collectively. And that's my big lesson.
I think there are difficult times ahead, but I completely agree. It's got to be a joined up approach. It's got to be everyone pulling in the same direction to the same ends, because otherwise, you know, if we split, we fragment, we will not succeed as universities, as organizations, and indeed as a sector. And, you know, the country, the people in the country, in our communities that universities serve, absolutely need that to happen. They need us to deliver all the things we
absolutely
promised.
And I'm sorry, I know you were trying to finish. I wanted to get one other name in, and it is somebody who had an absolutely enormous influence on me, and I would still recommend anybody who's a relatively new entrant to leadership in the sector to go back and read almost anything and everything he wrote. But David Watson, who was the outstanding Vice-Chancellor of my lifetime, for 15 years Vice-Chancellor at Brighton, and then he left that job at the age of 55 and went back to being a jobbing academic at the Institute of Education, which is where I got to know him very well before he went on to be Principal of Green Templeton College, Oxford, and very sadly died just 65, 66, so about 7 or 8 years ago. But he was always absolutely clear that the fragmentation of the sector into tribes and camps was a major risk, and he's absolutely right. You said to me, I'd worked in research intensive, I worked in specialist, and now I worked in teaching intensive. Here's my big leadership lesson. You know what? They're all pretty much the same. If you want to make things happen to them, in them, you've got the same levers. We're all more similar to each other than any of us like to admit.
I completely agree, whichever part of the UK that we're in as well. Chris, so you've announced you're going at the end of the year, or when your successor is appointed. There's been lots of praise for you from lots of different quarters, and no doubt it will continue to roll in. There'll be cheers, there'll be cries of joy as well. But I think there'll be more sadness than pleasure. I mean, you know, I just picked out this quote from John Gill at the Times Higher, who said, "Chris Husbands has been one of the most effective and impressive vice chancellors of recent years by any measure." I don't know what those measures are, by the way, but you know, I absolutely endorse the sentiment he argues. So do you know what you're going to do next? Are you going to, get that season ticket for Carrow Road and just spend your time, being miserable about the Canaries' performance? What are you going to do with all that time?
The short answer is that I don't know what I'm going to do. I decided, for a whole range of reasons, my decision that the time was right. I think as leaders, you have to decide when the time is right for you and for your organisation. There are a number of things in terms of time deadlines that cropped up that made this year a sensible time to go. The temptation is always to stay, but we have to. Yeah, you've got to be attuned to when's the right time to go. I wanted to go when I was still full of energy and enthusiasm, and I am, for the sector, for learning, for education policy. I'm not going to another job, and I'm not going with a plan in mind. But I'm hoping that things will that there will be opportunities. I'm not going to disappear, and I hope I can still find ways to exercise some engagement with the sector as it develops. I said to a mate of mine last night, she's not in the sector, that my horror at the moment was that this time next year, a chasm of emptiness would open up around me, and I would look back with nostalgia on working through the annual health and safety report or performance management meetings or signing off the annual report and accounts. So I've got things that I want to do and read. This is an all-consuming job. You're never off duty. The other little story I tell at this point, I was cycling back from one of our research centres in another part of the city about 6 months ago, and I got knocked off my bike. But the guy who knocked me off stopped, and we had a bit of chat, and we were waiting for somebody to come and pick up my mangled bike. And we got talking, and then it turned out that his granddaughter was doing a nursing degree at Sheffield Hallam. And when he discovered what job I did, he said, "Well, there's a few things I want to talk to you about," which he did. And that's absolutely fine. But that sense of never being off duty, I love it. But I hope I'm going to find some time to do some things that I hope are helpful to the sector. I hope will be interesting and will keep me from being too miserable about Norwich City results.
Great. Well, it's been a delight talking to you, Chris, and it's been lovely working with you over the years. And I know that we will all miss you, but maybe we won't miss you that much because you'll be back in some different guise. But thanks ever so much for your time.
Thank you, Paul.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.